Hello, my name is Father Gregory Pine, and I am a Dominican friar here in the province of St. Joseph, an assistant director for the Thomistic Institute, and I am delighted to welcome you back for another installment of Off-Campus Conversations, where we track down a Thomistic Institute speaker in the wild and say, wow, what's it like in your natural habitat? That's actually not true. We usually follow up on a conversation that that lecturer will have had with students on campus, but this provides us the opportunity to dive a little deeper. So, for this installment, I am delighted to be joined by Professor Therese Corey. Thanks for joining.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So, among our listeners, some will know you, some will be your students at the University of Notre Dame, some will not know you. And for that, they will profit from the conversation. But could you just say a brief word of introduction, who you are, where you're from, what you do?
Yeah, so I'm the director of the Maritain Center and the History and Philosophy Forum here at the University of Notre Dame. I'm also an associate professor in the philosophy department. I work on Thomas Aquinas, of course, and generally the thought of 13th century thinkers surrounding Aquinas and the Arabic influences on Aquinas. We're actually very excited about Aquinas here at the University of Notre Dame. We've just had a conference celebrating the 800th anniversary of his birth at the end of September. So we had about 600 people who were celebrating Aquinas's birth and sharing their research and listening to each other's research on the relevance of Aquinas today. So that was a very exciting opportunity for all of our faculty and students here as well.
That's, I don't know if people collect statistics on conferences and their sizes, but I mean, is that like the biggest Aquinas conference ever?
It could be. It could be. I mean, we don't have records. Maybe if we went and did some manuscript study, we'd be able to figure out if there have been in the past larger conferences on Aquinas. But I'm hoping that this was the largest ever.
Yeah, that's wild. I mean, I guess it depends on what you consider the Council of Trent to have been. I personally consider it to have been. No, just kidding. That's awesome. Yeah, that's really cool. And I think a lot of people might be surprised by that. For various reasons. I think like a lot of kind of Thomists in the wild, as aforementioned, just assume that they've happened upon this relic of the past. They find it corresponds with their experience. They're personally gratified, indebted, and delighted to study. And then they like come and explain that to somebody else, and they find that it also corresponds to that person's life too. And they're like, holy smokes.
This is real. People are talking about this stuff. Yeah, it's very exciting. It's definitely a very energizing experience to just see, you know, how many people all over the world, too, are still studying Aquinas.
Yeah. So it's cool that we are not just antiquarians, that there's something to it, which delights me. More on that later. Okay. So I thought I heard you give a lecture in the context of a conference here at the House of Studies. We've been celebrating a lot of things over the course of the past 2-3 years. So the 800th anniversary of St. Thomas's birth, the 750th anniversary of his death, the 700th anniversary of canonization. So it's been a celebratory time. And we had a conference here at the Dominican House of Studies in which you evaluated, St. Thomas Aquinas is still the common doctor for philosophy. And I was struck by kind of your approach to the question, the rigor and vigor with which you sought to answer it. And so I thought we could just follow up a little bit about philosophy, maybe your practice of philosophy. So maybe a good place to begin, a traditional place to begin would be with wonder. We've heard it said that wonder is the first step in philosophical inquiry, or it's the kind of disposition with which one begins philosophical inquiry. And some people might hear wonder and think bewilderment. Some people might hear wonder and think like a kind of admiration of the causal texture of reality. Some people might think totally different things besides. What do you think when you think wonder, and how does that conduce to the practice of philosophy?
Oh, that's a lovely question. I think, we like to say that philosophy begins in wonder. And if we think about this in light of Thomas Aquinas' own psychology, he talks about an appetite in the human intellect to know that, and this is connected to the famous Aristotelian maxim that all human beings by nature desire to know. So there's this impulse that we have to understand things. And I think in Thomistic terms, that impulse is precisely wonder. It's the moment at which we ask the question why, we're confronted with something you know, you go, you, it could be something very exalted. You go out for a hike in nature and you're, you see everything is very splendid and you're having this amazing experience. You say, why does any of this exist at all? So you might ask a very deep question, right? That's an impulse towards philosophical thinking right there. Or it might be something extremely simple, as when children are always asking why questions. It's one of the most annoying things that they do, as their reasons are beginning to develop. And you can see that they're having these philosophical moments where they want to know, why is the sky blue? Why can birds stay up in the air? And all of those are moments of wonder. Those are moments in which there's a move towards philosophical thinking. And I think it's important to recognize that you know, this can have a dimension of bewilderment. This can certainly have a dimension of being puzzled by why a reality is the way it is. But I think another thing is, just because we think, because on Thomistic terms, we think of this in terms of a kind of appreciation or a kind of appetite, that there's a kind of recognition, there's a way in which you're drawn. You're not just confused, but you're also drawn towards that reality to love it. There's a kind of love there that you want to know more about it. And I think that's essential to a Thomistic notion of wonder.
So I'm thinking about St. Thomas' description of studiositas and curiositas against like the Augustinian backdrop, some of St. Augustine's descriptions in the Confessions of this like kind of intellectual thrill seeking, or this kind of overabsorption in spectacle that his one friend suffers. He like can't look away from the games after having resisted the games for some time. So it seems like that wonder need be trained or disciplined in some way, shape, or form. Like for a child to ask why at the age of five is appropriate, if at times fatiguing for an adult. But if a grown person were to ask why with the same kind of approach, you know, like whatever, at the age of 40, I think we'd find that silly, boorish, inappropriate, right? So it seems like there has to be some kind of training or some kind of disciplining of that desire to know. What does that look like in the life of a philosopher?
Well, maybe one of the reasons why this is an annoying feature of child psychological development is the fact that the questions are not integrated with each other. So it's just whatever catches the child's interest at a particular moment, right? Why is that? Why are we going to the store? Why is the sky blue? So that the questions are not actually connected to each other. And we expect that as you get older, that's one of the things that you'll mature at, is being able to connect up the questions and have the questions sort of relate in an appropriate way to the context that you're in. So I guess I'd want to make a distinction in response to the proposal that you made, you know, that we would be concerned if an adult had this same disposition of asking why, because I think in a way we would, right, if they asked the questions in the same way as a child does. But in another way, I think having that disposition of wanting to understand and sort of always having that openness to understanding everything around you is exactly what the philosophical temperament consists in, you know, that we don't just go through the world taking but mostly everything for granted and then occasionally asking something about it, but we're really constantly trying to make sense of everything around us. So then we could ask, well, how is that different from curiositas, you know, which is this idle thrill seeking? And I think one way of making the dangers of curiositas or curiosity evident to us today is to think of curiositas as a way of approaching the project of understanding more in terms of gathering bits of information. Like, you know, I've learned all this trivia about something, or, you know, I think of understanding in terms of stocking my mind with a bunch of stuff I've memorized, which I can then repeat, trot out for people, or use to impress people in various situations. And really, this is fundamentally different from the wonder that begets the sort of philosophical investigation, which is concerned with a deep appropriation and understanding of the nature of things. And curiositas doesn't really concern itself with the nature of things. Curiositas is concerned with the surface. It wants to know a whole lot of details. But it's not interested in the integrating move, in the effort that it takes to actually link all of the questions that you have up to each other and come up with a vision of the world that actually makes sense in a holistic way. That's a lot of work. So I think that's really the fundamental difference, particularly from, you know, from the perspective of Aquinas. It has less to do perhaps with thrill-seeking in the Augustinian way and more to do with really misconceptualizing what it means to gather knowledge, really, in this sense of becoming wise.
Okay, so maybe for some people, this desire to know things in their deep down natures isn't immediately attractive, or at least as it's sometimes described in philosophical or theological conversation, like, I don't know if I'm motivated by that or animated by that pursuit, but maybe I need to do some excavation and find those kind of places in my heart where that still is present or at work, but perhaps in a dormant state. And I think maybe part of what it is like a lot of folks kind of engage with reality in almost, transactional ways. So they're thinking about what they can get out of reality. But it strikes me that the get out of philosophy logic, if there is a get out of philosophy logic, isn't so clear, or isn't so apparent. It's like study philosophy and change the world, influence. What is it that motivates, or what is it that animates? Like, why is the human person inclined by his or her nature to inquiry into the kind of deep down natures of things? What attracts that, or what drives that?
Yeah, I mean, so that's a question that one could answer along a variety of different angles. So one way we could ask the question is, you know, what is it in the human mind that longs for this kind of fulfillment? And I think the answer is just that's what a mind is. Is the mind is something? It's a capacity that we have. If we put it in Aquinas' terms, we're talking intellect here specifically. It's a capacity whose fulfillment consists in a complete conformity to the whole of being. Right? Then I'm talking on natural terms. Obviously, supernatural fulfillment consists in the beatific vision, but in natural terms, what we're supposed to do is we're supposed to grow intellectually into a complete image or model, let's say, of the entirety of creation. So we should think about this desire in terms of a kind of inner dynamism that the mind has towards its own, the fulfillment of its own nature, very much like I like to think about this in the way in which a plant grows towards its mature shape, right? Like we might ask, you know, I've got this sapling in my backyard and it's growing and it's going to grow in a particular direction into an oak tree. The branches are going to be arranged in a particular way. It's going to grow up and out. And why does it do that, right? And again, Thomistic philosophy of nature, we say, well, because there's an inner dynamism of its nature that unfolds in that direction. And so we can think of the human mind as having an unfolding of a similar sort. It has its own directionality, and the directionality that it has is to unfold into a complete sort of Porphyrian tree of the whole of being. So it's really internal to the mind. So that's one way of thinking about this question. But we can also think about it maybe more sociologically. Like, what is it that makes people want to understand things, as opposed to just going through life without ever thinking of anything? You know, and it's, I think, just pedagogically, when we're thinking about how to, as a philosophy professor, you're often thinking about, well, how do I awaken in my students this desire to know, this wonder? And it's not something that's formally exercised very much in the way that we tend to educate children. We answer their why questions, but we don't encourage them to make that additional step that we see in Plato's dialogues as being so important, which is the step towards asking, when we ask why, we should also be asking what is it? So that this move towards understanding what something is, towards definition as a way of understanding. So for instance, you know, and Plato dramatizes this really beautifully, you have all of these situations in which people are using terms like virtue and justice, and we're very happy to comment on the news and say this is just, this is unjust, this person is virtuous, this person is not virtuous. But at what point do we stop and ask ourselves, what is virtue? What is justice? So there's a way in which we're always asking philosophical questions, but there's also another way in which we need to support and motivate this more focused philosophical question, which is the question of what is it about the things that we're constantly dealing with in our ordinary life? And I think there, you know, a lot of times the reason people aren't asking that question is they're just not habituated to ask it. And that is the importance of philosophical education, is to teach students how to ask those questions in their own lives, and then to be able to see how incredibly fulfilling and important it is to be able to live with the insights that you gain from asking those questions.
I've been teaching a class on the virtue of courage, but last semester I taught a class on the cardinal and moral virtues more broadly. And so thinking about courage and temperance, both Aristotle and St. Thomas will describe them after the manner of like removing what prohibits, kind of like getting junk out of the way or disciplining those things which can gunk up or junk up. And so when it comes to the type of pedagogy that you describe, it strikes me that there are various things that can gunk up or junk up, like various obstacles or hindrances which can arise in a person's life, which prevent the individual from kind of pursuing a kind of inquiry along the philosophical lines that you've described, which will lead on to, yeah, kind of speculative insights and contemplative wonder and maybe even something like happiness. When it comes to removing those things which prohibit, or when it comes to addressing various obstacles or hindrances to the philosophical life, I think, you know, there are things that people will probably think of automatically, like, well, you know, I think often of this line from A.G. Sertian. She says, the truth serves only its slaves. And we might find the language of slavery unsavory and for good reason, but at the very least, like, truth serves only those who are bound to her, you know, that are like wed to her. And so, you know, like we're going to be tempted by ideology or by advocacy or by, you know, whatever coping strategies or ways in which we seek to anesthetize ourselves to the difficulty of life, because like service of truth is, it's like brutal and exigent. So I'm just wondering if you have any, yeah, kind of thoughts or even counsel apropos of, you know, like addressing obstacles or addressing hindrances which arise to the discipline discourse, which you've described at this point.
Right. So I think one thing I'd want to say is that, you know, we often tend to see practical concerns and the pursuit of truth as being somehow different tracks that you can be on and you have to pick one or the other. This is expressed itself in the traditional tension between the active and contemplative life. As I'm sure you know, this has been a common theme for the Dominicans for a long time. But you know, if we go back to Plato and we think about Plato's cave, and he has the image of the philosopher that exits the cave, right, and sees the forms and is reunited with things as they truly are, away from the shadows that are just deceptions. Well, what does Plato think the philosopher should do next? And he describes him as having this impulse to, and also an obligation to, go back down into the cave and free more people. So a preliminary thought is that, you know, whatever maybe one of the things that hinders people in engaging in this philosophical search for wisdom is the thought that, well, it's going to be merely theoretical. It's going to be something that's going to take me away from dealing with the real problems, the serious social issues that face our communities today. And I think that tension is not something that needs to divert us from philosophical thinking. I think we should think of those two projects as really complementary. It's the experience that we get of there being problems that makes us ask questions about what a more just world would look like and what justice is, for instance. But that philosophical knowledge that we achieve should also make us more engaged rather than less with the problems that are facing society and with communicating those truths to other people. So the truth will set you free, right? If we go back to the metaphor of the cave. So that's one thought. Another thing that I love to return to in thinking about the hindrances to the philosophical project and the growth in wisdom is a beautiful quote by Jacques Maritain, of course, the patron of our Maritain Center here at Notre Dame. And back in the 50s, he did an interview with the director of our Medieval Institute back then, Gerard Phelan, in which he talked about one of the things that he loved, some of the things that he loved about Notre Dame students that were attending his seminars back at that time. So he gives a really interesting list. So what he says is there's a laudable freshness, goodwill, genuine desire for knowledge, natural intelligence, modesty, and absence of cynicism. He says these are the things that he finds in students that he's taught in America. And then he says, however, there's a kind of problem of too much docility and a certain lack of confidence in their own insight. And I always think this is a very interesting list. I mean, you could pick a bunch of items off of this list to comment on. But one of the things that I think is particularly important here is the lack of cynicism that he highlights. As you know, cynicism as an obstacle to this quest for wisdom. And so you think, what does cynicism do exactly to hinder us in this respect? And I think cynicism is a kind of hopelessness, right? It's an expectation that no matter what you do, nothing's going to change, nothing's going to work, you can't actually gain any kind of knowledge. You know, and we see this all over in society now is this kind of general hopelessness that manifests itself either in a kind of skepticism about what we can know or a hopelessness in what we can achieve socially. And it's important to see that, I think, as a key obstacle to philosophical reflection, because we have to be able to have that in order for the appetite, for the desire to know, to be really unleashed, we have to have a confidence that the desire can actually get us somewhere. And so I think one of the key obstacles that needs to be removed to philosophical contemplation is precisely to give students hope that the exercise of your reason can get you somewhere. Maybe we don't have the confidence that we did in the Enlightenment, that reason can get you everywhere and you can do everything with reason and answer all the questions. But this idea that reason has a natural dynamism towards its own good, I think, is a really important idea to remediate this kind of obstacle.
So it's, you know, hearing you cite the words of Jacques Maritain, apropos of students at Notre Dame in the 1950s, I don't know students at Notre Dame in the present, but just kind of speaking of the cultural moment, I don't know that many people would identify lack of cynicism as a kind of distinguishing positive characteristic of, you know, this present day and age. Maybe that's wrong. Maybe that's like, I'm just thinking of millennials and Gen Z and Gen Alpha as kind of coming more on board with the truth. Because, you know, you heard a lot of conversations maybe 10, 15 years ago about the via pulchritudinis and how we need to lead with beauty and onboard to goodness and eventually arrive at truth, because like there's massive disaffection with authority, truth claims more broadly, and as a result of which we can't expect people to assent except that they have that truth commended to them by something, you know, like beautiful, something good. But maybe we're getting back to a kind of post-cynical dispensation because, yeah, I don't know, maybe it's like, it's easier. I don't know, I'm trying to convince myself of something, but I actually don't know what I think. Maybe what do you see in the generation of your students? Do you find them kind of tending back in the direction of what a former generation might call like dopey gullible, credulous? Like, are they willing to believe things? And if they are, or are they willing to open themselves up to truth discourse? And if so, like, how or like, what is it that is commended that approach to them in the current setting?
Yeah. So when I started teaching, which was 15 years ago, we talked a lot about relativism as being a fundamental obstacle to students in philosophy classes taking seriously philosophical discourse. Because if I have my truth and you have your truth, then what are we doing in a philosophy class actually discussing something? There's no point, right? And I think the landscape has shifted, actually. Now, so people are still, when students come into intro classes, they're still using the language of relativism. They're habituated to thinking in those terms of, well, I have my perspective, you have your perspective. But deep down, they don't mean it, I think, in the same way as students 20 years ago did. And I think it's an interesting shift in the dynamics of philosophy classes now. This is just, I don't know if other people have observed this, but this is just something that I've noticed in my own classes. And what seems to be the case more now is, and I think this is maybe the result of a greater awareness of, social issues, where students are much more habituated now to talking about racism or other social ills, and to taking a strong position on those topics. So despite the sort of blanketing of the discourse in relativistic languages, what's underneath is actually a pretty robust grasp of morality, right? That some things are just really wrong and some things are right, and defending people against what the wrong things that are being done to them is right. You know, and I think that's a really positive development in terms of moving in a direction where you can actually get traction on a theory of moral realism and a real robust distinction of right and wrong. And of course, the challenge then is sort of reconciling those, getting students to recognize the tension between those two impulses, the relativistic language and the impulse in the direction of an objective moral structure. But I think because the tension is there, that's a great opportunity for us to be able to point out, these two things don't actually fit with each other. And so that provides an opening then for thinking about, well, what is right and wrong? And can we develop a theory that of justice, of virtue, that supports this idea that there are, in fact, things that are really permanently and fundamentally wrong to do to other human beings. So I see that as actually a really positive development for teachers of Catholic philosophy in the future.
I just read Mere Christianity again, and I was struck that C.S. Lewis begins with right and wrong, basically our experience of right and wrong and our moral intuitions. And then the observation that we transgress our moral intuitions, like we have a sense of what's right and yet we do what's wrong. And then when we do what's wrong, we typically don't call the standard of right into question. We try to like rationalize or justify or do whatever we can to fall within its bounds in our own eyes and in the eyes of our contemporaries. But like, we don't typically throw the standard of right out entirely. And I was like, yeah, that's fascinating, because 30 years ago, I'd have said, a lot of people are trying to do just that. But now, it's interesting, those things about which we feel strongly, they require from us a kind of moral realism, which requires from us a kind of philosophical realism. Like, you can know some stuff because that stuff is, and then you can conform your life to that stuff because like the alternative is bad.
Right. Yeah. That's good. That's a good direction to go.
I'm here for it. Right. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think, that gives rise, if there's the social challenges that we're constantly facing and talking about. So that's been helpful in one way. In another way, I think it's created another kind of obstacle that is a new thing that I'm still learning how to deal with in the classes, which is, I think we've just had such such an experience, maybe through social media, the news, division in families about religion, about politics, the volume of outrage and anger and fury and hatred of the other side that have pervaded these kinds of discussions. I think we're now seeing a generation of students who, for whom they're coming of age, right? As they're emerging from middle school into high school, they just have known nothing else, no other kind of discourse in the broader public as they're thinking about how do I contribute to these discussions in society. And this is how the discussions are unfolding to them. And the result, I think, is this tremendous unwillingness to engage in disputes face to face, which is something that's very challenging for a philosophy classroom. You need to be able to have a back and forth where people have these different views and they argue with each other and they try to come together to a better insight into something. Maybe they learn to agree partially. They find they have some common ground, but not common ground in another area. You really learn from that kind of activity. And going back to Plato, I mean, he recognized the only way in which you make any kind of, you grow at all intellectually is through this dialectic. It's the friction back and forth of one thought on another contrary thought. That's how you grow. You know, it's like a muscle. You need to encounter some kind of resistance in order to build muscle tone. So I think that's something that there's almost a kind of like national traumatization around engaging in discussions that just, we just don't want to do this anymore. Like there's just too much disputing. It just feels so, we're just so overburdened with this constant outrage on and on and on that's just drumming into our ears. And so how do we separate philosophical disagreement about fundamental concepts, right? How do we separate that from this other thing that's just so exhausting? And I think that's a big challenge just in terms of, again, stimulating that desire to wonder, to be able to overcome that sense that we just don't want to have these kinds of conversations.
Yeah, I find that very fascinating. And maybe just as a kind of last question, this is more speculative, so feel free to cut loose as you see fit or, you know, beg off. It's interesting. Okay, if it is the case that the natural law cannot be blotted out from the heart of man, then this natural law desire to know the truth about reality, to know the truth about God, will continue to well up within us. And provided we, you know, exercise some modicum of discipline in trying to address those obstacles and hindrances which might prevent that desire from coming to expression, then we're going to have to find settings, you know, outlets in which to host these discussions and come to a deeper knowledge of the truth within the setting of the human community. So, but if most of those settings, the ordinary settings, are places in which we don't feel like safe and secure, or places in which we expect to encounter more by way of irrational opposition than rational engagement, then we're gonna create new settings. And I think that's kind of what we're seeing. Like I was reading an article about how Gen Z reads the news, and you know, it's like if you watch the news among different generations, like with your grandparents, your parents, you know, and your brothers and sisters, it's like your grandparents are like gospel truth. Your parents are like, I'm not sure if that's exactly the case. Whereas like you and your siblings are like, this is advertising. You know, like this isn't, I don't know what you think news is, but it's just now what you think it is. And so like Gen Z, they'll read a headline, they'll basically skip the article, and then they'll go to the comment box to see how the community has adjudicated the claims. And then they'll base their position off the tone, which most directly maps onto their tone. And so it's like truth, evaluation or determination on the basis of popular acclaim. And then also by like, but on the basis of affinity, you know, like perceived affinity, which is fascinating. Like, you know, when you damage a certain part of your brain, the rest of your brain will just account for that and then try to, as it were, reroute, you know? So like, yeah, I guess, you know, you're working in the context of an institution, you know, like a kind of traditional setting in which these types of conversations are often hosted. But you also, you know, you're responsible for this institute, which is trying to broaden that conversation or kind of infuse that conversation in different parts of academic life. So when you think about what might the settings be in 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, 20 years, where are places that you see this conversation developing or hosting this conversation in a healthy and happy way?
Yeah, so I think really fundamentally the way forward is to get these kinds of conversations offline and into groups of human beings that are sitting around a table together face to face, because the online setting is not conducive to the kind of respect, the kind of listening, the kind of understanding that marks a genuine conversation that aims at a shared, a new shared insight. And what we really need is, I think it becomes more important than ever to have, you know, classrooms that have small groups of students that are actually talking to each other about things that are deeply important, and that, you know, philosophy, I think philosophy is a huge contribution to make here. And particularly, I think the role of instructors in these classes in modeling the kind of attitude, the kind of intellectual attitudes that we need to try to inculcate in our students. So to me, this is a lot of what we're dealing with right now is it's a fundamental human problem. We have these tendencies. We tend to think, I think we've always tended to think in ways that are, you know, that prioritize what our group is already thinking, what people that we respect are already thinking. We tend to give much more credence to views that we think are have the stamp of approval from people we care about. That goes all the way back. You can see this Plato responding to these kinds of dynamics. It's a basic human thing, but that's also been exacerbated, I think, in really terrible ways by social media and by the kind of online discourse that everyone is plunged into, the comment boxes and all that stuff. And really what we need to recover is the role of the personal contact in human communities, where we're looking each other in the face and we can recognize each other as persons, each person also oriented to this common end that we all have, which is truth, which is understanding the truth. And that sort of rehumanizing of the discourse, I think, is essential to being able to actually to change these attitudes of cynicism and sort of hopelessness in the face of seeking understanding together. So I guess that's what I hope to see more of, is people sitting around a table talking together. And maybe I also hope to see, you know, more of people in the community who are modeling that kind of attitude and those kinds of conversations in a public way for people to be able to look up to and say, yes, I see this is how it can be done. These are, you know, how rare is that now that we see two people that disagree about something sitting down in a very public venue and you can actually watch them disagreeing and say, oh, actually this is okay. And these people are friends and they're disagreeing, but they're also coming to some mutual understanding. So more of that I would love to see, but it's very hard to create spaces for these sorts of things, because that's not the kind of thing that people want to click on, you know?
Yeah. No, not the type of thing that stirs the passions, which we like to feel.
Yeah.
But not ultimately.
That's what we
Great.
Do.
Well, thanks for taking the time. Thanks for chatting it through. I appreciate that. I thought maybe just a last question is, are there programs at Notre Dame or through the Maritain Center that folks can inquire into further, whether during the academic year or over the summer?
So I mean, for students at Notre Dame, we have a Maritain Fellows program that for students who are interested in pursuing more of the thought of Thomas Aquinas, the Thomistic tradition, the Catholic intellectual tradition more generally. We invite speakers to campus. There's reading groups. So definitely for interested students, look into that. And we also have, coming up later this week, I give a shout out to my colleagues at the DeNicola Center for Ethics and Culture, that they have a wonderful fall conference that happens every fall, starting on October 31st this year. It's on the beautiful theme of imagination. I know these are huge conferences that a lot of people come to, and very inspiring venue. So I'd love to encourage everybody to check that out.
That's awesome. Thank you. Thanks for taking the time, and thanks for contributing to the conversation.
Thanks for having me on here.
All right, turning to you, the listener, thanks for tuning into this episode of Off Campus Conversations. If you haven't yet, subscribe on YouTube or your podcast app, unless you don't want to, and then don't. Know of our prayers for you. Please pray for us, and we'll look forward to chatting with you next time on the Thomistic Institute podcast.